We all know that women are not funny. And no one proves it better than Kay Ballard, the accidental lawyer who is the accidental host of our show. Of course, every accident that Kay Ballard encounters is intentional. And now her intention is to accidentally disprove the show's premise. So sit back and enjoy a fun conversation that matters between Kay and today's fabulous featured guest. Welcome to Women Are Not Funny Radio.
Hello, this is Kay Ballard, and I had been hoping you'd come by because today's guest is someone so worth listening to, and that is Michelle Woodward, someone who always has something to say. Now, she proves this daily, but recently she proved it in a very big way by publishing her second book, a compilation of essays called I Am Not Superwoman, Further Essays on Happier Living. Now, some might argue with Michelle's assertion that she's not Superwoman. No, she doesn't change her clothes in a phone booth, but she is someone who has accomplished feats just as astonishing as leaping tall buildings with a single bound. Michelle has had a stellar career at the highest level. She was on the staff at the White House. She was a senior VP at a very prestigious Washington lobbying firm. And now she's a master certified life coach with the Martha Beck Organization, as well as the creator of her own very successful programs for career coaches. She's an author, a high ticket personal coach, the mother of two teenagers. I think she just might be Superwoman, and if she's not, we're going to make her prove otherwise. So here's what we're going to be talking about with Michelle today. Her book and the things she apparently believes in and whether and why. Now, I'm very excited about Michelle's book, and I hope she sells a bushel basket of them or more. I read it and I love it. There's someone who is very well known for interviewing authors, and he always says, buy three of whatever book he's talking about. He says, buy one for yourself, buy one for someone you know, and buy one to have on hand as a gift. Well, I'm very competitive, and when it comes to Michelle's book, I recommend that you buy a dozen. And here's how I do the math. I say buy two for yourself, one to read and one just in case you drop the first one in the pedicure basin. Buy five for your friends because surely you have at least five friends. And then buy five more to have on hand as gifts. That works out to be a dozen. Michelle, what do you think of that idea? Do you think that everyone should buy a dozen of your books?
From your lips to God's ears. That's all I'm going to say because, you know, right now I think it's the 128,000th best-selling book on Amazon. So if everybody bought 12, maybe I'd get up to 65,000 bestseller.
Well, I you know what? Actually, I checked that today. Mm-hmm. And you're not giving yourself enough credit, but, I mean, more importantly, even though it is a rather large number, you know, you're down the list a little bit, that's still quite an accomplishment. You know, there are many successful authors who are on at the 2 million range. So, you know, congratulations on that.
Well, you know, I think every little bit helps. And, of course, I'm not Janet Ivanovich or Charlene Harris. But, I'm happy with the book. I really like the book, which is a good thing for an author because it would be hard to be out there suggesting people buy a dozen of them if you really thought it was kind of schlocky.
Well, of course. But here's what I think our listeners want to know, is how your book is going to help readers.
That's such a great question, Kay. I think it helps readers, it helps people who read it by making it, first of all, they're fun to read, and you read the book, right?
Yes.
They're fun, they're engaging, the language, you don't have to have an advanced PhD in literature to be able to read it. But what I hope to do in all the essays is show people that there's another way, that life doesn't have to be so hard, and that you can just make simple choices that change the trajectory of your life and make it happier.
Well, why do you think that's important?
I think was it Thoreau who said massive men lead lives of quiet desperation? And I think that there are a lot of people who are quietly desperate. When I think about the people that come to me and ask me to help them in their lives, in their careers, there are a lot of people who are really unhappy, and they feel like this is the way it's always been and this is the way it's always going to be. And what I know for sure is that it doesn't have to be so desperate.
Well, you know, as we pre-agreed, and there's so many things that we could talk about, but we actually agreed that today we'd pretty much talk about your book, and that's what I want to do. And yes, I have read it, and as I'll explain to you, and I know you understand why, but I'll explain to everyone, I've read it twice, actually. And it's not because I bought two copies. You were kind enough to send me a review copy. But here's what I want to talk about, mm-hmm. about your book. I want to talk about the process of writing the book. I also want to talk about the title of your book and what that implies and what that means and, you know, kind of generally give you a hard time about it. And then I want to talk about what's in the book, some of the specific things that I read and particularly were interesting to me because, you know, ultimately you are the featured guest, but this show's about me.
You know, that's what I've always understood and loved about this show, Kay. It is all about you, and I consent to that wholeheartedly every time I agree to appear. So let me talk about the process because a lot of people get all bollocked up when they think about writing a book. These essays have appeared before on my blog, and so every week I write an essay-length blog post. So unlike some people who have very short and pithy blog posts, I know yours are actually challenging and engaging. Mine are about 600 to 800 words. And so by just steadily writing every single week, rain or shine, you know, ill or well, I end up with 30 or, well, actually, I end up with 52 a year, you know, because math was never my strong suit, but I do know math. And so I end up with 52 a year, and I selected about 35 of them for this book. And it's a great way for some people who are my readers, you know, actually, I polled my readers, and they said that they would love to have an actual book. And so that's why it came out in the book form, because my particular people are not necessarily people who are going to be surfing blogs. So I wrote it gradually every week for a couple of years.
Well, yes, you did. And what you did was to follow a very well-established and highly venerated process or model that was established many years ago by newspaper columnists who are the successful ones anyway. And as you know, because you modeled them, they, every 2 years, they put out a collection of their best and most popular columns. And the thing is, though, Michelle, even though it is a great way to write a book and a great model to follow, I think it's probably a little more difficult task than you're stating to select those 30 or so and put them in order and so forth. I know there was some book work involved, even though the essays were pre-written.
Yeah, there is work involved, and I tried to select the most popular ones and then the ones that hung together. And, you know, they're all my babies, and so to discard certain ones because they had too many, you know, hyperlinks, for instance, or that they just didn't fit, or some reason almost felt like, you know, Sophie's Choice. But I think the hardest thing is to just stay focused and committed to writing every week. You know, there's some weeks when there's a lot going on and maybe I'd prefer not to write, but it's a discipline that has sort of surprised the hell out of me, to be honest with you, that I have been that disciplined. I started my blog in 2006, and I think I've only missed 2 weeks in those 4 years of writing. So it's that commitment to myself and the commitment to my readers that I really hold on to, and then the end result is I have this material that I can use in a book. So that's how it all works. It is interesting, though, I have to say, to look at this body of work from, like, the big macro picture and see the themes that keep coming up and the word choice that I keep, you know, the words I keep choosing. It's pretty interesting to me.
Oh, yeah. Listen, no doubt. And as someone who looks forward every Sunday to receiving what you've written, you know, we do, I'm speaking for everyone, and they ask me to certainly speak for them. We look at our inbox, you know, and then if it's a little later in the morning, we go, well, where is it? And since I know that they come out on a mailing system that would permit you to pre-schedule it, I think, oh, okay, so she's, you know, taking another look at it, maybe a last look before it comes out. Anyway, for me, when I said I read it twice, that's exactly what I mean, because many of the essays, I was taking a second look at them because I'd read them before. And so it was so fascinating to me. It was a very different context in two different ways. One is that, as you say, as the writer, you go back and read them and remember. I did the same thing as a reader. I remembered when I read them, kind of what was going on in my life, what I thought about at the time. In some cases, I remember what was going on in your life. And so it had a very interesting aspect. From that standpoint, it was just kind of fascinating. But then also, to have them together that way and arranged that way, it also put it in a different context to be reading them. So I loved it. You know, I absolutely loved it. It is a very different thing, I think, than just going back and reading someone's blog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I call me old-fashioned. You're supposed to say old-fashioned, but I really, there's some certain alchemy that happens when you have a printed book in your hand, and I believe that so strongly, and I did poll my readers in, I guess, March, and asked them, would you want a book, would you want an e-book, what would you like, and, you know, hands down, my readers said, please make a book. And what I'm hearing from people who've been reading the book, because it's only been out for, 2 weeks, is that, you know, the people tuck it into their pocketbook and read it, as you said, you know, while getting a pedicure. And because the essays are, you know, a couple pages each, you can read a couple and put the book down or keep it in, you know, the console of your car and, you know, check in while you're waiting for something. I wouldn't suggest people do that while driving because Oprah will get mad at us. But, you know, it is the kind of book that I think is easily digestible, but also makes you think.
Well, you know what? It is perfect for that, and that's why I mentioned the pedicure. The other reason I mentioned the pedicure is because of a couple of unfortunate experiences. But, you know, my own blog, New Media Martini, was published this week on the Amazon Kindle, and speaking of that, a word from our sponsor.
Women Are Not Funny is brought to you today by Kindle Pimp at KindlePimp.com. If you like to read, and you know that you do, you will love the Amazon Kindle. Go buy yourself one today at KindlePimp.com.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
So that's another thing that's interesting. We both have Kindles, and you talked about how your readers want the feel of a real book. Once I got a Kindle, Michelle, for me, there was no going back.
Yeah, I could paraphrase that, but women are not funny, so I'm not going to paraphrase it. But, yeah, it is interesting, the shift towards electronic media. But you can't, you know, put a Kindle book on your shelf. And so I still got that thing where I like to have my little books there on the shelf. And I have another one coming out in the fall. Did I mention that?
No.
see, I keep secrets. I have one coming out about how to do a job search, so it's a little bit different than the other two books. But I find that so many people ask me about how to do a job search that I thought I might as well just put it all in a book. But we can talk about that book next time, another time.
Yeah, let's talk about this one today because I really have to dig in a little bit about the title. When I read the title, I thought, well, because the title is I Am Not Superwoman, and I just wonder, when you selected that title, surely you thought of some others.
Well, you know, in the first book, I took one of the titles of one of the essays and made it the title of the book, and that was Lose Weight, Find Love, Declutter, and Save Money, which I was at a social occasion with Hoda Kotb of the Today Show, and I gave her a copy of the book, and she tipped it with her little fingernails. It went, yes, 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 and yes. So to kind of continue that with this book, I just chose the title of one of the essays that I thought would kind of summarize my entire body of work. You know, Lose Weight, Find Love, Declutter, and Save Money is this thing that a lot of people, those are the goals that a lot of people set for themselves. It's the thing that you see on most, you know, infomercials and a lot of internet sales, all these things that you can do to lose weight, find love, declutter, and save money. And so that's why I picked that one for the first book. For this one, when I was looking through all the blog posts that made the cut, I really realized that part of what I'm trying to do is help people get liberated from their the ideas that there are a lot of things that they should be doing. I don't believe in shoulds. I believe in, you know, choosing. So the whole point of I Am Not Superwoman is that it's great to not have to appear to be perfect. It's great to kind of revel in your imperfection because that's really where creativity lies and that's really where openness is and that's where the promise of real growth is not worrying about having other people think you're perfect. Now, the flip side of that, Kay, is that there are people who are perfect. You happen to be that kind of person. So in some ways, the title doesn't really apply to you, I guess.
Well,
again,
and I'm not,
once again,
you're
I brought
right
it right
about
back.
That.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right about that. Yeah. But here is my question, and I want an honest answer from you, Michelle. I really do. I insist upon it. Did you consider for a moment naming it I Am Superwoman, na-na-na-na-na?
You know, I didn't, but boy, it may be in the second edition. I'll change it. Because that's really good. I like the na-na-na-na-na. That's very important.
Well, and you know, I think it's pretty accurate because I think you pretty much are, as I made the case for in the opening of this show. How about this? Did you think about calling it I'm Not Superwoman, but I sure as hell wish I were?
How about Pretty Damn Close? I could see that, too. No, I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of women out there, unfortunately, who feel like they have to be a certain size and drive a certain kind of car and be married in a certain kind of way and live in a certain kind of neighborhood and send their children to a certain kind of school, and all that will lead to happiness and contentment. But what they find is it kind of leads to misery and unrealizable, you know, just unrealizable perfection. And so, I mean, as fabulous as I am and as much as I adore the life that I'm living, I'm not really perfect. And I'm actually pretty happy not being perfect because it takes a lot of the stress off. So,
well, that's all well and good. But I think the problem for a lot of people is knowing when they are throwing in the towel and giving up and not aspiring high enough and knowing when to say it's okay. You know, it's a really hard question that everyone who is not perfect faces.
But it's that I think there's almost a compulsion to create that is the thing that need that that any of us need to honor. You know, it's like a singer's got to sing. You know, whether they are on American Idol or they have a recording contract or whatever, a real painter paints because she really just feels this urge to express herself in this way. And yesterday I had a thing on Facebook, which I know you abhor. So, but I did say I really believe that creativity is, at its core is really risk-taking. And if you stop taking risks because you're afraid of what other people are going to say, then you really are thwarting the whole creative impulse. And so I'd rather create and create imperfectly than not create at all. The creating is my lifeblood. And so I'd rather do it and fail than not do it at all.
Well, I totally agree with you there, you know. And
the Baked Alaska of failure, if I'm not
exactly. If I didn't agree with you, you know, there wouldn't be this lineup of my creations that are of questionable value. But here's, I guess, what I'm really asking, and not doing a very good job of it. Is there any reason to fear a slippery slope of low expectations?
I think I will answer that the way my economics professor did in college, it depends. And I think, you know, it really depends that if I have the expectation that I'm going to be, you know, a starting linebacker for the Washington Redskins, it's kind of an unrealistic expectation. They don't take a lot of women, first of all, and they don't take a lot of 50-year-olds, second of all. So I could bust my brains out trying to get, you know, on with the Washington Redskins, and frankly, they could probably use me. But I'm shooting for something that's kind of is on its face extremely unrealistic. And so throwing in the towel on that idea of playing linebacker is actually a very prudent, smart kind of plan. However, embracing my love of football, getting myself season tickets or wangling invitations to sit in the owner's box is a great way to a realistic and a very positive way to express my interest in football. Do you understand where I'm going with that?
I totally understand, but I'm still not done because, you know, I think that most of the potential readers for your book and actually, most of the people out there have pretty much of a clue whether or not they could qualify to play NFL football. And only a few knuckleheads who couldn't would be going after that as a go. But I'm talking about the really daily experience that a lot of people have in knowing when it's okay to say, oh, I've done enough, and when they ought to find some self-encouragement and self-leadership to go on.
You know, and I guess the point that I would that I quit. I mean, that's really what we're talking about is when do you quit? And you know, I think you quit when it's no longer fun, right? And you're just banging your head against the wall, and if it's not really fun and you're not really growing, you know, you're not learning something. I mean, I believe in challenge and I believe in testing myself and I believe in pushing myself to get a better result. But I also know that when I'm absolutely, my energy is sapped, I feel bad, you know, in my body. I just got to stop. And, you know, some people, we talk about people know that they can't play football, but have you ever watched the American Idol tryouts?
And
the
if
number
I
people,
have,
and the
I
people
shall
who,
not admit them. I shall not admit it.
But the people who stand up there and think that they're the next, you know, Celine Dion or some singer, and they're horrible. So I think we can delude ourselves.
Well, Michelle, I'm all in favor of self-delusion. You know, I mean, I thrive on that. And And speaking of that, I mean, recently, and I haven't seen it, and I probably won't, but Sex and the City 2 came out, and it has gotten the worst reviews ever. I'm sure you're aware of this. But when I read it, I've taken them personally, you know, and for no reason. I'm not in the movie. I haven't even been in the theater, but, you know, I read arrogant, self-absorbed, materialistic, and I think the reviewer is talking about me. And the same thing happened when I read your blog on Sunday and you were talking about the fizzy people, the incoherent drama queens. I read that and I, you know, I was just flattered.
Well, you know, I have to say that it wasn't quite you that I had in mind when I talked, when I thought about that, but, you know.
Now that I mention it, maybe. Well, here's what happened when I sat down to read your book, and this was about 10 days ago. I'm well into it. I'm three-quarters into it, and as I said, I really enjoyed it and gave it a lot of thought as I went through. But at that point, I just asked the question. I said, what are you, some kind of cockeyed optimist? And I swear, the first sentence of the very next essay was, so people ask me, what are you, some kind of cockeyed optimist? I could not believe it. So what are you, some kind of cockeyed optimist?
I'm a psychic cockeyed optimist, obviously, because I can read your mind, you know, many months past. No, I do think I am by golly an optimist, and I really do think having an optimistic outlook can be really positive. But I'm also a pragmatist. I mean, for goodness sake, I worked in politics, and you have to be able to have a pragmatic view. But I always do believe people are generally good in the world, and they generally want to do the right thing. And coming from that sort of starting point. Yep, I'm a cockeyed optimist.
Yeah, well, I kind of believe that myself. But truly, the book is optimistic and practical. And I picked out three of your essays that I'd kind of like to talk about today. Of course, we don't have all the time in the world, so I'm going to tell you what they are, and you can decide which one we go with first, and we'll just talk about as many as we can in the time we have remaining. But the three, and these are not necessarily my favorites, but these are our favorites. You know, they're not that maybe I didn't pick out the top three, but I picked out the three I would like to talk about. One is what I will call the Roy Rogers story. Two was falling in love with potential. And then the third one I'd like to talk about is your essay about gifts and getting rid of gifts. So where would you like to go first?
Well, the Roy Rogers thing, I think since you promoted that, you know, when you promoted this call, we should probably talk about it. And it was a funny time in my life because I did work at Roy Rogers restaurants, which I don't know if people who don't live on the East Coast know about Roy Rogers. Do you think they do, Kay?
I think they don't, and I tell you what, my parents lived in the Washington, D.C. area for most of my adult life, and my father was a big fan of that place. In fact, I can imagine that he actually was at some time a customer at your Roy Rogers restaurant.
You know, I think he probably was.
But he was, because what he loved, Michelle, I don't think he liked the food, but he did love it that the people who worked there would tell him happy trails.
Happy trails. I did. I was required to say not only happy trails, but would you like a holster of fries? Because that was the large fry. That was the suggestive selling part. So Roy Rogers was the big, you know, cowboy matinee idol of the 40s and 50s. And in when I worked, and there was a chain of restaurants, and when I worked for them, they were actually owned by Marriott. And then Marriott sold to Hardee's, and then they went out of business. But nonetheless, it was hugely Western themed fast food restaurant. So I wore a red and white straw cowboy hat. I wore a white peasant blouse, which, of course, we couldn't have off our shoulders because that was simply not done. And then I wore a red and white calico skirt that came up, you know, a little bit above the knee. And I was required with every guest that came in the restaurant to say, "Howdy, partner, can I take your order?" Now, you can hear my voice. I still know how to do the script. "Howdy, partner, can I take your order?" And then the next thing I was sort of required to say was, "Would you like a holster of fries with that?" And then as the order was filled and they were leaving the counter, I was required to say, "Happy trails." And if you didn't do it, like if your friend from high school showed up and, you know, just stood in front of you and made you say, "Happy trails, Carol," you still had to say it, because if the manager, if you did not say it, the manager could dock your pay.
Well, that's only reasonable, Michelle.
Yeah, that's right. And so I learned a lot in that job. You know, I learned there were several people working there who were grown-ups, and this was a very important, you know, they're a very important full-time job. It wasn't just a, you know, after-school, high school-y kind of larky, you know, get enough money to go buy jeans, a new pair of jeans at the merry-go-round. This was their real job, and they took it very seriously, and that gave me an awareness, you know, about respect around people's work. I also learned about how important suggestive selling is. That's important in the work that I do, is, you know, suggesting people work with me is a kind of a good thing. I learned how to rotate my stock, which sounds so completely silly, but let's say that I go to the store and I buy another can of Progresso soup, which I happen to be kind of fond of. I'll always put it behind the other cans of Progresso soup. And that way I'm always using the oldest can first, which is really dorky and stupid, but it's something that I learned when I was 17. And I've been doing it, you know, all these years since. So I think that suggestive selling, which is really kind of gets to be the point of this essay, is something that a lot of people aren't comfortable doing. But in I've been working with people recently a lot around finding jobs. And the interesting thing is the number of people that I'm working with who are meeting with their contacts, and in the course of their conversation, they'll say, "You know, I'm really looking for a job where I can blah, blah, blah." And the other person says, "Oh, how about if I hire you to do that?" That's nothing more than suggestive selling. And I've had several clients have jobs created for them in the last several months because they've had the nerve to suggestively sell themselves without a holster of fries, which is, you know, something else.
Well, you know, that's great. I have a memory from many years back when someone I took to lunch, we were exploring possibilities of doing business together, and she said to me, "Let me tell you what my dream is, because I like to tell everyone, because I never know who might be involved in making it come to pass." Mm-hmm. And I thought about the power of that statement and what a good idea it was. So.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to write a blog post pretty soon, unless you decide you want to write it, in which case, you know, go ahead. But it's like how to brag. You know, a lot of us don't say things like, "Oh, let me tell you about my dream." One, because we're afraid people will laugh at it. Or two, we think it maybe sounds a little too smug or self-assured, something that our mother told us that we shouldn't be. And so we don't say it. But since we don't say it out loud, we really jinx our opportunity for it happening. So I really urge my clients to say it. You know, say it out loud, whatever it is that you want. You want a boyfriend? Say it out loud. You want a girlfriend? Say it out loud. You want a job as a senior vice president? Say it out loud, and then you're more likely to get it.
Well, absolutely, and that kind of leads us to, and I'm just going to go in order since you didn't really specify your favorite, but it leads me to wanting to know more about your ideas about the folly of choosing based on potential.
You know, it's I had a girlfriend once who was dating this guy, and she said, "You know, he'd just be perfect if I could get him to lose 40 pounds." And I really physically recoiled at the idea of that she was dating this guy and she was, quote unquote, falling in love with him. But she's falling in love with the idea of him 40 pounds lighter, which means she's not really seeing him at all. She's seeing the potential of what it would be like to be involved with somebody who's 40 pounds lighter.
But you know what they say? They say that women fall in love with the man he can become, the man, they fall in love hoping he will change, I think is the way the saying goes, and men fall in love hoping the woman will never change.
Mm-hmm. And who do they divorce? So, you know, I mean, the truth is we fall in love with potential. We fall in love with the idea that someday, you know, he's going to be a doctor, and then therefore my life will be easier. I once had a client who said a single woman who was not dating and having a difficult time finding guys to date, and she said, I just have this, you know, I just really want to find a man who, you know, can put together these tables from IKEA. I'm so tired of working with screwdrivers and hammers. And I said to her, well, what if you find a guy who absolutely has no interest in screwdrivers and hammers? You're still going to be doing the IKEA stuff. And I think that's the idea. We fall in love with this dream, and then we don't allow the person that we're involved with to be a real person and be themselves. They have to line up with our idea of what their potential is, regardless of what it is that they really want. You know, there's a writer that I like. He's passed away now, but Henry Nouwen was his name, and he was a Catholic priest and was at Harvard and Yale Divinity and also at Notre Dame. And he defined love as making a safe place for someone else to be fully themselves. And if you subscribe to that idea of love, you'll never really fall in love with potential. You'll fall in love with the person as they are. And I think that's the point at which you can really have a successful relationship.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thought and something to look to. Where I've really encountered danger is, and I've done this over and over and over again, is falling in love with the potential of a house. You know,
mm-hmm.
Oh, this house could be so great after I fill in the blank, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then what you are doing is you are buying for yourself a life of a couple of months or a couple of years of misery as you try to bring it there. And people can do the same thing. You know more about this than I do, but they can do the same thing with falling in love with the potential of a job.
Oh, absolutely. Or they have selective hearing, and they only hear what they want to hear when someone describes what the job's going to be like. And that's so absolutely dangerous. You can fall in love with the idea that, you know, I'm going to work my way up, and I'm going to take over from this guy, and I'm going to end up being the CEO or whatever. It's great to have a vision. But if the guy who's hiring you happens to be the son of the founder, you're probably not going to take him down. You know, I mean, to be really realistic, it's not going to happen. And so, you know, falling in love with potential is fraught with danger on a lot of levels. And falling in love with reality is just so much nicer.
Well, one reality that you looked at in your book is the reality of gifts,
mm-hmm.
and the value of gifts. And that was just, to me, just the greatest thing ever.
Well, what did you like about it?
Well, you know, you actually went in a lot of different directions in that essay, and you kind of started in one place and went in others. But, you know, sometimes if something is called a gift, there is a lot of guilt associated with not liking it.
Yeah, and especially when, for instance, the gift is the gift of a relationship with me. You know, there are a lot of people who feel like that's a really, really great gift. But if it's a relationship that diminishes you or hurts you or in some way, you know, causes you to be less than you could be, then it's really no gift whatsoever. I mean, if you're in an abusive or a dangerous relationship, that's no gift. I was also thinking in that essay about the gifts, the legacy gifts that were handed down by our families. You know, these gifts around ideas around what money is or what money should be, or what it means to be, you know, born into a certain family, or, you know, even what we serve at Thanksgiving. All those things are gifts that at some point you really have to decide, is this gift really good for me? Is this really helping me be a better person? Or is this gift sort of holding me back, making me feel anxious and make me feel like crap? Because if it does, then you should get rid of it. It's not a gift. I feel like
that's
I'm preaching.
True.
I feel like I'm preaching.
That's true. No, well, you know what? And what is wrong with that? Mm. I have always looked at that as kind of maybe the true dream job, you know,
mm-hmm.
one that I am qualified for in every way except being religious. And so, you know, I think preaching is cool. I think it would be very, very cool. So what is the dream job these days?
I think a lot of people have a dream job of being their own boss. I think for a lot of people, they have an idea, they fall in love with the potential of not having other people tell them what to do, being able to set their own pace, being able to, you know, kind of create their own vision for their lives. I think for a lot of folks, that is a really powerful concept of what a dream job is. What's really fascinating to me is that because of the economy, a lot of people have been forced into, you know, creating a consulting practice. You know, they've been let go. I was talking to somebody yesterday, let go from Booz Allen or Arthur Anderson or one of those big things, and started her own consulting firm. But what she realizes is that she does not like working by herself, that she's really at her highest and best when she's working with other people in a team. And so we talked about how can she characterize that when she's out looking for a job, because what she's doing is a lot of people's idea of a great dream job. And she's doing their dream job, but she's not happy. And so I think so a lot of people have this fantasy idea of what it's like to have your own business, but they don't really know, you know, the unglamorous side. I mean, you've had your own law practice and other consulting practices. I mean, it's not as glamorous. Well, maybe yours is. Maybe your life is much more glamorous. I don't know.
My life has been pretty glamorous, but you know, my business currently has a lot of challenges,
mm-hmm.
and I think a lot of people are facing that. And so the thing, you know, the thing I think one has to do is, from time to time, remind ourselves when we're facing some challenges, remind ourselves of some of the payoffs as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, I think that there are always payoffs, and always keeping yourself in alignment with, you know, with what's really best about you. What are your strengths? What are your, you know, your priorities? What are your values? What are the things that really make you passionate and happy? And do more of those. And do less of the stuff that just doesn't work. I think that's the secret to life.
Well, yeah, I agree. But I know, I also know all too well, you also believe in doing the hard stuff.
Mm.
You really do.
Yeah. I believe it's so very vitally important to have the hard conversations, to have the hard discussions, to be, you know, to be frank with yourself. It is a challenge to be frank with oneself. But when you are really frank, then life actually becomes a ton easier.
Well, you've already said that all of your essays are your children, so I can kind of predict the answer. But which is your favorite essay? Do you have a favorite?
You know, I kind of, part of it depends on the day of the week and the you know, where I'm thinking. I'm actually looking at the table of contents just to tell you. I really like that one, The Simplest Solution, about Occam's Razor, which, you know, the idea that all other things being equal, the simplest solution is probably the correct solution. I think that we make things so hard for ourselves because we think sometimes life has to be hard and life is about suffering. But the reality is when things are effortless, that's when you know you're in the sweet spot and you're doing what's right, because it is effortless. You know, when I'm playing to my strengths, when I'm really in the zone, it feels like even if something is hard, it feels effortless. Even if it's a challenge, it feels effortless. Even if I'm growing, it feels really great. And so I think that idea that when in doubt, the simplest solution is the best choice is something that I try to keep in mind, so that I don't get in my own way, and I try to just keep moving forward.
Well, that is a beautiful thing to remember, and I want to remind everyone listening that they're to buy a dozen of Michelle's book, I Am Not Superwoman. Michelle, thank you, darling. Come back, please. But the next time, promise me that we'll have an actual argument. Wouldn't that be a lot of fun?
I'm actually making notes as we speak about the things about you that piss me off. So the next time we talk, we can talk about that. How about that?
You have been listening to Women Are Not Funny Radio, a New Media International production. On behalf of Kay Ballard, her fabulous guest, and the secretly hilarious Women Are Not Funny team, thanks for being here. You can listen to our replays anytime you please, but it's so much more fun when you're here. So join us again live next Friday afternoon for Women Are Not Funny Radio.